news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe, taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program, and I'm excited as always to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear, and going in pursuit of the enigmatic, as we do every week. Listen on demand via podcasting apps all throughout space and time, and of course, via our station affiliates over at the UnX Radio Network. Interesting times in recent days. You know, we've got mysterious launches out of Cape Canaveral occurring in recent days. The discovery of hidden corridors inside one of the world's most enigmatic ancient monuments. And of course, also what one Hollywood director recently said about UFOs and the prospects of the discovery of alien life. But something that really captured my attention in recent days was the publication of a new science paper by a friend of the program and the director of the DoD's All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick. Yes, that co-author is Dr. Avi Loeb, Harvard professor of astronomy and also the director of the Galileo Project. Avi Loeb's going to join us to give us all the details on this extraordinary paper, where he and Dr. Kirkpatrick have now teamed up, they've put their minds together, and they are trying to find ways to use known physics to place constraints on UAP. What does that mean? Well, really, it all comes down to this. For years, there have been discussions about these observable characteristics of UAP that really make them extraordinary. These things seem to be highly maneuverable, sometimes capable of incredible acceleration. Some of them, at least a small number, according to the reports that have been issued by the ODNI in recent years, seem to be capable of signature management. What does that mean? Basically, it comes down to using electronic means to make yourself less easily detectable. And when we're talking about all of these different characteristics, often something that has been applied to the UAP debate, or going back to the days when they were called UFOs, many researchers have argued that these advanced capabilities these objects appear to display are so advanced that they are almost magical or otherworldly. You're probably familiar with Clark's third law, talking about Arthur C. Clarke, of course, and he'd said that any significantly advanced technology observed by a lesser advanced civilization is going to view that technology as being tantamount to magic. And we often do that with UAP. We look at these things and say, these are characteristics that simply defy physics. In fact, we may require new science, new physics altogether in order to reconcile some of the observed characteristics these objects have. But is that necessarily the case? You know, if you ask a physicist, they're probably going to tell you that the laws of physics, perhaps incomplete though they are, but nonetheless well known to the extent that we do understand physics of the universe, they remain constant, and they allow us to make predictions about things that happen all throughout the universe based on the constancy of those physical laws. So why would any kind of technology, ours, theirs, or anybody else's, and no matter how advanced, why would it not conform to the laws of physics? It is possible that there are aspects of physics that are not yet well enough understood to account for all of the things that such a highly advanced technology might be capable of. But in this new paper by Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick and Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb, they fundamentally argue we should start first with the known physics, and we should apply that toward UAP, and we should not build expectations around the presumption that just because these things appear so advanced, some of them, that they therefore display physics that are not yet understood and seemingly are impossible based on our understanding of physics. No, they say, let's work with what we know, let's see what that helps us predict about UAP, and let's see if those predictions don't help us actually identify and characterize them better than we have been able to do in the past. So I reached out the moment I saw this paper, and I asked Dr. Avi Loeb, would you be willing to join me and be our guest? And he was kind enough to drop everything and jump on the mic with us. So this is going to be a great conversation with Dr. Avi Loeb about this paper. really interested in getting his perspectives too about collaborating with the head of Aero at the DoD, but we'll get into that and much more in just a bit. First, here's what's happening right now in the news. According to CNN, there were 4 U.S. citizens that were pronounced missing in recent days after being assaulted and kidnapped in Mexico. They were reportedly targeted by mistake, according to U.S. officials, but this is a story that strikes somewhat close to home for me, because down there at Matamoros, Mexico, where this occurred on Friday, these individuals in a vehicle apparently were driving. They had a North Carolina license plate, and now authorities are trying to find out where they may be. According to CNN, at this preliminary point in the investigation, it is not believed that the American citizens were in Mexico for criminal purposes, but photos obtained by CNN show the car believed to have been driven by the Americans, where it crashed with another vehicle before they were taken at gunpoint from the scene. We're not really sure exactly what happened here, but the FBI has weighed in. They say they wouldn't confirm the authenticity of those images, but CNN says they have actually confirmed the authenticity of the photos and video with a U.S. official with knowledge of the investigation, and that they also were able to geolocate the images. So here's what we know right now. There are 4 U.S. citizens who crossed in a white minivan with that North Carolina license plate. They were abducted on Friday shortly after crossing into Matamoros, Mexico. The photos obtained by CNN, they say, show a woman looking and then sitting next to 3 bodies outside the white minivan. All the doors of the van were open. Of course, this investigation is still ongoing. I guess we will see where this one goes. But again, if they weren't suspected of criminal activity, if this was some sort of a misunderstanding, this could be a concerning situation. Indeed, our hearts go out to the families of those who apparently have been taken hostage down there. Meanwhile, here stateside, another mystery is unfolding right now. Down there around Cape Canaveral, the intrepid Ty Rogaway over there at the war zone, reporting that social media was abuzz over the last few days with what he says appears to be a looming test launch of some kind of undisclosed rocket or weapon system out of Cape Canaveral Space Force Station. Now, what is about to be launched? Well, there are some speculations that it could be the test of a hypersonic weapon. And in fact, according to Mr. Rogaway, that seems highly likely. Now, over there at the war zone, he laid out the case for this argument in an article in recent days. He says signs that such a test could come began a couple of days ago when various hazard warnings were being posted. The launch window then extended throughout the weekend and into late Monday afternoon. The pattern shown of hazard areas does not seem to match common orbital system launches that are, of course, what you usually see happening down there. Subsequent temporary flight restrictions that are common for launch operations have been put into place as well. So he says this is looking very much like it could involve some kind of a weapons test. Then, of course, you look at all the information that was being posted on Twitter by open source intelligence operators out there. That's one of the most incredible things to me, by the way, about Twitter. In this era of spy balloon shootdowns, unidentified objects, and mysterious launches from Cape Canaveral, you can find all kinds of information that people gather through open sources and post on Twitter. Almost anybody, if they know where to look and how to process that information, can become an intelligence analyst in their own right. And so, citing sources familiar to us here at the Micah Hanks program, like the Intel Frog and others over there on Twitter, Aerospace Intelligence being another one, Ty features a lot of these tweets in his article, which I'll have linked in the show notes. You guys take a look at that and tell me what you think they might be about to launch down there from Cape Canaveral. But now applying some of the advanced technology of today to the mysteries of the ancient past. We have, of course, in the past featured episodes on this program about the Great Pyramid of Giza and efforts by what is known as the Scan Pyramids Project to try and use non-invasive techniques to discern what might be happening within the Great Pyramid. And of course, they had already located in years past this so-called mysterious void, the Great Pyramid Void. We did an episode about that, and in fact, due to my interest in the Great Pyramid and really all the monuments of ancient Egypt, you may be seeing this particular podcaster on a program on one of the popular networks in the days ahead talking about some of this. More on that at a later time. But actually, I'm citing the work of my good pal, Chris Plain, over there at thedebrief.org, who was writing about the latest discoveries by the Scan Pyramids Project, which they say now have revealed that there's an undiscovered corridor inside the Great Pyramid of Giza that they have now also unraveled. This, of course, in addition to that mysterious void that we dedicated an episode to on this program last year. And here is how they say that they have managed to do this. According to Mr. Plain's article, muon tomography involves detecting a type of subatomic particle known as a muon that is created when cosmic rays slam into Earth's atmosphere. And then once created, muons only last a fraction of a second, but researchers are still able to use muons produced by cosmic rays moving at nearly the speed of light and large numbers of them slamming into and even passing through the Earth to track their decay and, more importantly, the way that they pass through the stone of the Great Pyramid, which allows them to peer into the structure's interior and reveal these fascinating facets of the construction of the Great Pyramid. Now, as I told you guys on the episode we did about this, and if you haven't heard that, if you're new to the program, maybe having found us through the debrief.org, maybe having stumbled upon us from the reporting that we provide every week on the ongoing developments regarding UAP, you'll want to go back in the back catalog at micahanks.com/podcast and check out the episode that we did on the Great Pyramid Void, because I presented my own speculations about what some of these mysterious internal structures within the Great Pyramid might actually reveal, not only about the purpose of the pyramid, but perhaps also how they were constructed. Yeah, there are all these questions about where the evidence of the technologies used to construct the pyramids are. People have long said that a single ramp that would have been used to carry blocks all the way to the top of the pyramid in the final stages of construction would have required structures almost as monumental as the construction of the pyramid itself, and there definitely would have been evidence of that, and yet we find none. And this has caused some archaeologists to wonder whether or not the ramp system, presumably it was used in the construction of the pyramids, might have actually been incorporated into the structure itself. And so my theory, not to give too much away, I want you to go back and listen to that episode from last year, but my theory is that maybe some of these cavities and these incline passages and things that are being revealed with muon tomography by the Scan Pyramids Project, that these might actually be showing remnants of the actual system that was used to build the pyramid itself. Wouldn't that be fascinating if muon tomography revealed not only what's inside the pyramid, but more importantly, in the years ahead, maybe finally put a cap on the question of how they were built? But if you want my pal Chris Plain's take on this, be sure to jump on over there to thedebrief.org. I'll have this one in the show notes too. One more story we've got time for here before we get into this conversation with Dr. Avi Loeb about the new paper he co-authored with Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick of Arrow. Steven Spielberg's been making headlines in recent days because he apparently appeared on the Stephen Colbert program and had a few things to say about E.T. I'm not just talking about the film. No, he was actually talking about extraterrestrials and UFOs. Apparently talking with a late-night host, he said he had never seen a UFO himself, and I'll quote from a portion of the transcript here. Spielberg said, "I wish I had. I've never seen anything I can't explain." But he added, "I believe certain people who have seen things that they can't explain. I think what has been coming up recently is fascinating, absolutely fascinating, and I think the secrecy that is shrouding all of these sightings and the lack of transparency," he says, "I think there's something going on that just needs extraordinary due diligence." The director goes on to say, "I don't believe we're alone in the universe. I think it's mathematically impossible that we are the only intelligent species in the cosmos. I think that's totally impossible." And he says, "At the same time, it also seems impossible that someone would visit us from 400 million light years from here. Except in the movies, of course, unless it figures out some way of jumping the shark, so to speak, and getting here through wormholes." Is that necessarily the only mechanism, though, that UAP might use to get here? I wonder, of course, what Dr. Avi Loeb and Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick would have to say about that. And if you happen to have seen their recent paper over the weekend, and you read that, as I did, it's a quick read, and even those, I think, without an extensive knowledge of math and physics will still be able to glean some insights from this paper. I definitely recommend that you have a look, and of course, when we come back after the break, Dr. Loeb is going to be here breaking down how he and Dr. Kirkpatrick decided to come together and have a meeting of the minds, and what exactly they say that known physics may be able to help us discern right now about some of these advanced characteristics that some UAP seem to display. And perhaps even more importantly, I would argue that, reading between the lines a bit here, Dr. Kirkpatrick's participation in this paper and its publication may also give us an idea of some of the kind of things that the DoD is currently assessing, thanks to the efforts of the Alderman Anomaly Resolution Office. We'll get into that and more here in just a moment. First, of course, as I am often apt to do, I gotta remind you guys about one of the most important things that you will ever be tasked with caring for in your lives. And that, of course, is your health. And look, I take my health really seriously. And by seriously, I mean I exercise daily, I try to eat healthy, and of course, I also try to get as many minerals and supplements into my diet as possible. Because, as the old saying goes, you are what you eat. And really, that extends to your entire lifestyle. You are what you do, how you care for yourself. And so that's why I always try to tell you guys that one way that you can enhance your ability to care for yourself is to do what I do and take AG1 by Athletic Greens every single day. Because AG1 is going to provide you with increased energy, immune system support, and also better gut health. It's going to help you sleep at night and do so by providing you with additional nutrients, adaptogens, all natural quality sources of nutrition that will supplement your lifestyle and, of course, your daily nutritional needs. Every morning, and I'm not kidding, every single morning I start my day by pouring Athletic Greens into a cup of water and taking that on an empty stomach. That, and of course, that hot cup of coffee every morning are how I like to start my day, and it really kickstarts my energy before my daily exercise. And I tell you about it because I believe in this. It's something that is going to help you like it has helped me. And if you find it hard to take pills and to remember to take all these different supplements and things that so many of us do incorporate into our diet every day, remember that with AG1 by Athletic Greens, it is a one-stop shop where you will get all of these different vitamins and nutrients and mineral resources in a single daily dose. All you do is add it to water, you stir it, you drink, and you go. And it's as simple as that. So now you know why I do this and why I enjoy it so much. But I want you guys to try this for yourselves and find out what an additional 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients added to your daily regimen will do for you. Trust me, it'll be a game changer. So listen, if you're looking for an easier way to take supplements, Athletic Greens is giving you a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. And to get that, all you've got to do is go to athleticgreens.com/Micah. That's athleticgreens.com/MICAH, my name, Micah. athleticgreens.com/Micah. Check it out, and I promise you, you're going to enjoy it as much as I do. All right. And when we come back, I am eager to dive into this new paper by Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb and Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick of the Alderman Anomaly Resolution Office. This is hot off the press, ladies and gents, and so we are very delighted that Avi would join us on short notice to discuss this. That is coming up here in just a moment when we return on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. So how do we use known physics to place constraints on unidentified aerial phenomena? Admittedly, with all my interest in this subject, I'm probably not quite qualified to be able to do that as well as the gentleman who joins us now, and who of course was the co-author of a recent paper that was brought to my attention over the weekend. This one is definitely worthy of attention. And it's going to be making the rounds in the days ahead, so you might as well get the full update right here and now. And of course, that's why I am delighted to be joined at this moment by Harvard professor of astronomy, Avi Loeb, who is also the head of the Galileo Project. He is the author of the book Extraterrestrial, The First Sign of Intelligent Life Beyond Earth. He's got another book coming out later this year we will ask him about. And of course, you can also read his column over there at thedebrief.org. That's called Our Cosmic Neighborhood. And so let's get right into things with him. Our guest, Dr. Avi Loeb. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Indeed, it's wonderful to have you here. Again, you barely need an introduction anymore. I mean, you're all over the place these days, Avi. You've really become not just a science communicator, but one of the leading voices in a burgeoning area of science. So to begin, what's new in the world of the Galileo Project?
Well, first, I should say with respect to the scientific method, I'm surprised by how much pushback I get from both sides. On the one hand, the mainstream of academia, my fellow astronomers, who are not open-minded enough to seek evidence for things that we are not familiar with. And that includes, of course, objects like Oumuamua that looked weird, including the two meteors that we discovered, and we are going on an expedition to retrieve the fragments of one of them in a couple of months. But there is pushback. People are not willing to entertain the possibility that we might be missing something about our cosmic neighborhood and that there might be a smarter kid on our block. And why would we push against that? It offers an opportunity for us to expand our horizons, to learn more. I'm being funded by private donations. It's not taking money out of any other scientific project. Nevertheless, traditional thinking wins the day. So that's on the scientific side. But then you find on the other side, people who are willing to believe in notions without having evidence for them. And that includes Steven Spielberg, who was interviewed a couple of days ago by Stephen Colbert. He was suggesting that maybe unidentified aerial phenomena are extraterrestrial. Obviously, that's a proposition that can be the foundation for scripts in Hollywood, but it doesn't stand up to the standards of science. You can't just believe what your imagination tells you. What you should do is be guided by evidence, because reality is not necessarily what we expect it to be, what we wish it to be. That's why when people look at the mirror or they take a photograph of themselves, very often they decide to put makeup or to change Photoshop their image. And in a way, you know, reality is under no contract to make us happy. And the only way for us to educate ourselves about what it is, what its nature is by collecting evidence. Now, why is that important? Because this allows us to adapt to it. Nobody expected quantum mechanics a century ago, and yet we found it in our laboratories. So then, once we understand it, we can use it. So the reason the two of us are communicating is because of the internet, because of computers, cell phones, so forth. All of these technologies would not be possible without us understanding quantum mechanics. So what I'm trying to say is evidence may surprise us, but it should guide us under no, without any reservation. We shouldn't have a guide based on our imagination. And unfortunately, this is not common sense. I mean, common sense is not common. That's another way to put it. Both in academia and in the general public, people prefer to stick to their traditional beliefs. And what the Galileo Project is trying to do is basically address this question of whether there are objects that were manufactured by extraterrestrial civilizations near Earth. That's a very simple question. It's a question that any kid can understand how to resolve. You know, the way to resolve it is to look up, to use the instruments. I mean, in soccer, there was the World Soccer Cup in Qatar, and there were some controversies. It wasn't clear exactly what is going on, and video cameras resolved some of these controversies. And so if referees of FIFA are willing to attend to evidence from video cameras, why should we not adopt the same approach when dealing with unidentified aerial phenomena? And of course, there is some data the government collected, but it's classified. And asking the government to declassify it, will not necessarily result in anything, because the sensors that were used to collect this data are classified, so the government will not release that. But the sky is not classified. So let's just follow the approach of soccer referees and look up and try to figure it out ourselves. Why should we rely on what other people say? Eyewitness testimonies are not reliable. In car accidents, you have people involved in car accidents, and each of them says something different about what actually happened. So the point is, we should not use humans as detectors. Humans are not scientific detectors. It's instruments. And that's what the Galileo Project is all about, bringing some sanity to this discussion. You know, it's really simple. Let's look at the sky 24/7 from many locations and use artificial intelligence, you know, the latest algorithms for classifying objects in order to identify natural objects like bugs, birds, rocky meteors, and distinguish them from human-made objects like balloons, those balloons that the government shut down in recent weeks, or drones or airplanes, and see if there is anything else. That's a really simple question. Why do we have to argue ahead of time? Let's just collect the evidence. So that's what the Galileo Project is about. And we have a first observatory already operating. We are starting to test our artificial intelligence algorithms. And we are planning to build a second system by summer 2023 and then build more and more copies of this system. And the number of copies will depend on how much funding we have. The first system cost me $250,000, you know, that's quite expensive. And I very much hope that people who see our results will donate to the project.
Absolutely. You know, I tell you, it's such an incredible time right now with everything that's going on. And since even the last time that you and I actually spoke, so much has happened. Now, to that point, you recently published a paper titled Physical Constraints on Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. Tim McMillan sent me this yesterday. I read it with gusto. And it's one of the most interesting science papers. I'm not just saying that because I like you, Avi, and we're friends. It's one of the most interesting science papers I have read on the subject to date. But also of interest is the co-author of the paper, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, director of the DOD's All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office. So before we get into the paper itself and the science that is discussed in it, how did this collaboration with Dr. Kirkpatrick come about?
Oh, he just said that he's visiting in the area of where I live and asked if he can meet with me. So we met at my home. I mean, during the pandemic, I had lots of visitors, some of which donated the few million dollars that established the Galileo Project. It was really an interesting time about, you know, including people from the private sector, people, you know, that are artists and so forth. I had 2,000 appearances on podcasts, you know, interviews from magazines, newspapers, radio stations, all across a period of about 2 years. And so when he wrote to me and said, I'm in the area, may I visit you? And I said, of course. And he came, sat at my living room, and we discussed the subject. Now, you know, I am a scientist. So, you know, I didn't sign any NDA. I'm not, I have no exposure to classified information. And he knows that. And so he said, well, it would be a good idea to write a scientific paper that sort of sets the boundaries on, you know, based on the physics we know. If there is incomplete data from instruments, what can we say about the distances, the speeds of objects? And the following morning, actually, after a couple of months where there was a paper by Ukrainian astronomers, people told me about the paper, the authors of the paper wrote to me, and it didn't smell right to me. I mean, they were claiming that the data was not really of high enough fidelity. But the following morning, I decided to look at it, and I realized they were claiming distances of 10 kilometers, speeds of, you know, 10 kilometers per second, and size of, you know, 10 meter objects moving and being completely dark. Mm-hmm. And my point was, you know, if these objects are dark, they block light, therefore they interact with electromagnetism, therefore they must interact with the molecules of air, mm-hmm. therefore they must deflect the molecules of air as they move through the air. And they definitely would produce a fireball if they move at a speed up to 15 kilometers per second, as claimed, above the escape speed from the Earth. You know, any meteor moving at that speed creates a huge fireball. You know, creates of this size, it would create something bigger than the Hiroshima bomb energy release. You know, like that would be huge. So how can you see a dark object and claim that it moves at such a high speed through the air? And so I just wrote a paper saying, look, this makes no sense. And in fact, the amount of energy emitted is proportional to distance to the fifth power, fifth power. So if they made just a mistake by a factor of 10 in distance because they did it from one site, usually to measure distance reliably, you need multiple sites. If they did it wrong by a factor of 10, it will be just an artillery shell. And if it's a factor of 100 in distance, it could be just a bullet, you know, passing by. So they have to demonstrate by measuring the same dark objects from multiple sites that their distance measurement is correct. So that was a simple assessment. And then I got a lot of pushback from believers in UFOs being extraterrestrial. Anyway, that was a paper back then. But since then, we were working on a paper together with Sean Kirkpatrick, and that is the one that you saw.
Yeah, and it's great. I even recall you and I emailing about that, because when I read your first paper that talked about the expectation that there would be this luminous sheath that would, of course, encase an object moving through the air at that speed, I'd written to you and said, you know, I mean, if you look back at the history of this subject, historic discussions about UAP describe this kind of luminosity. So I thought, you know, Avi's really onto something. So let's get into some of the science in this paper. It addresses these physical constraints based on standard physics involving known forms of matter and radiation. That's all we really have to work with, and we have to try and deal with what can abide by the laws of physics, which is everything that we know, and maybe some things that are unknown. Can you discuss the development of this idea and really the elements that you cover with Dr. Kirkpatrick in the paper?
Well, there are two important points that physicists have been struggling for 5 decades to find evidence for new physics. And, you know, there was the Large Hadron Collider that cost $10 billion. No new physics. It was just all, you know, old news that the Higgs boson exists. And obviously, there are lots of other experiments, and people are working really hard to find new physics. So you can't just say, you know, maybe there is new physics, maybe there are things that we don't know about, just because measurements are incomplete. So we have to respect the laws of physics as we know them. We can't just say, forget about it, whatever my imagination allows me is possible. That's not a valid approach. You know, when you deal with plumbing at your home, you have to attend to known physics. When you change a light bulb at your home, it's known physics. When you deal with your bank account and the, you know, the information that you get is known physics. And then when you see a UAP, suddenly you say, oh, this is new physics. And why would that be the case? The burden of proof is on you. Mm-hmm. You can't just say it's new physics because I have incomplete data. The data is not conclusive. I cannot measure distance well. It's the other way around. You have to measure distance precisely. You have to demonstrate that this object is moving in ways that we cannot explain using known physics. And then you might be able to consider new physics. Okay? So the burden of proof is on those who claim new physics. That is a fundamental facet of the way we do science. You use what you already know, because that was demonstrated, and you can't just imagine things like Steven Spielberg imagines in his Hollywood scripts. That's science fiction. The difference between science fiction and science is evidence. Evidence is critical for us to be sober. You know, we can take recreational drugs and imagine a lot of beautiful things.
Oh, yeah.
We can also put goggles on our head and imagine even more beautiful things in the metaverse. Some people make money out of that. They sell you recreational drugs. They sell you these goggles. You can consume these things and feel good about yourself. But that's not science. Science is about the reality that we all share, okay? Meaning that we can reproduce it with instruments again and again. Meaning that if Moses in the biblical story was reporting about a burning bush that burned on and on without any supply of fuel, we would believe this story if Moses had infrared cameras that measured the amount of heat produced by the burning bush for as long as it was measured, and then demonstrating that no fuel was supplied to the burning bush so that indeed it's a miracle. That's the way to demonstrate new physics. You can't just say, I see a burning bush. That is not enough. Eyewitness testimonies are often associated with wishful thinking, with phenomena we don't fully understand, simply because we don't have good enough. Let me give you another point.
Please.
Another example. So in the Tic Tac incident that a lot of people go back to, and by the way, there is no point in going back to old stories. The key is to use the best instrumentation we have now in order to get new data in the future that is much better than those that had those reports had at the time. So my point, supposing the Tic Tac incident, I mean, people say they saw an object moving extremely fast from one point to another. Now, suppose there was actually a swarm of objects. You know, like, suppose you drive on a highway and you see a black car in front of you. And then you see a black car behind you. And the one in front of you disappeared. Why? Because it went on an exit. But you see a black car behind you. You say, wow, that's amazing. I see faster than light motion of a black car. Now, how do you know it's the same car? That's the key. You have to see the license plate on the car in front. You have to see the license plate of the car behind you. And then you would say, I have evidence that the car moved faster than light. You can't just say, I saw a black car and then I saw another black car and therefore it moved or it did something crazy. This is not science. This is eyewitness testimonies, which could be wrong. They can be fooled. You know, a cat chasing a laser spot would think that the laser spot is doing miraculous things, but it's not. It's just a spot of a laser and you are running after it. So, you know, in science, we have to get complete information about what's going on before we express our, you know, understanding or misunderstanding of what it might be. But you can't just based on partial knowledge and your imagination claim it must be the case. You can say it's possibly the case. There is this possibility. There is another possibility. So one possibility is the distance that the Ukrainian measured is wrong, which is the possibility that I had that. And the other is that there is new physics associated with their objects. That the possibility that many other people adopted. And I say, at this point in time, we cannot tell the difference because the measurement was not good enough. So if you want to show that there is no physics, you have to do a better measurement. It's not my duty. It's your duty if you want to argue no physics. As long as we don't have that evidence, we stick to known physics. So that was the underlying theme of the paper that I wrote with Sean Kirkpatrick, basically saying, this is the physics we know, from lots of years of laboratory experiments and, you know, life. You know that the known physics describes life as we know it because all the technologies that you are taking advantage of are based on our understanding. So it works. You know, physics works. That's the amazing thing. When you follow physics, it works. Now, if you claim there is no physics, you have to provide evidence that the known physics is not explaining it. But as a starting point, we have to use what we know because that's the only sober approach to reality, the reality. That, and then, okay, so what does known physics tell us? If you have incomplete data, you can constrain the distance because otherwise you would have a fireball. That's what I was talking about before. If you imagine a real object based on known physics moving really fast, if you ionize or break the molecules and atoms of the air into their constituent electrons and ions, and that would have a radar imprint, and you should see that. So the point of the matter is, suppose you are not seeing these signatures, then using known physics, you can put limits on the distance. And that is the approach adopted by all scientists all the time, concerning things in the universe at large. And it works. It works. Many times we figure something, you know, we constrain it, and then we find that it's the correct constraint. So if we don't find that it's the correct constraint, it may be new physics. And of course, that is the way to expand our knowledge. I'm not ruling this out. In fact, I would be very happy if we have new physics associated with UAP.
Sure.
But we have to start from known physics.
Indeed, you do have to start with the known physics. And of course, we're in luck right now because nobody probably knows the physics, at least as it relates to the UAP question. Right now, better than the man who joins us, Dr. Avi Loeb, Harvard astronomer and co-author of this paper, with the head of Aero, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, which he's going to be telling us more about here in just a moment when we get back into this conversation on the Micah Hanks Program. Placing physical constraints on unidentified aerial phenomena. That's what we're discussing this week with my guest, Dr. Avi Loeb, a former Frank Baird Professor of Astronomy at Harvard University, currently the head of the Galileo Project, and co-author with Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, head of the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office over there at the DOD, of a new paper looking at these questions and how we can apply known physics to the phenomenon. I do want to remind you before we jump back into this conversation with Dr. Loeb that if you aren't already an X subscriber, you're only getting half the story. And for weekly additional content from yours truly and the guests that we feature on this program and monthly specials like the Enigmas program, all you got to do is head on over to MicahHanks.com/X and you can sign up and become a subscriber. The link, of course, is there in the show notes, along with all the stories we discuss each week and much more. So with that, getting back into the known physics involved in the study of UAP, of course you have to start with the known quantities and look at the possibility that if these characteristics, the boundaries that you set, so to speak, are not met, that we may not be observing something that's truly extraordinary and otherworldly. It also could be a problem with the measurement, which we're going to get into that in a moment as well. Dr. Loeb, before really getting into some of these physical characteristics and the constraints that can be placed on UAP based on the calculations you and Dr. Kirkpatrick performed, there's some very important background information which ties in with your work regarding Oumuamua that's outlined in this paper. It involves the detection of near-Earth objects and interstellar objects like Oumuamua in the decades, actually the last two decades leading up to now. What have those last couple of decades taught us in terms of searching for space objects and the likely nature of maybe even extraterrestrial technologies and also what to look for?
You know, Enrico Fermi 70 years ago asked in Los Alamos during lunchtime, "Where is everybody?" He was referring to the extraterrestrials. And, you know, that's a very lazy question because it's like someone sitting at home and saying, "I don't see any extraterrestrial next to me, therefore I don't have neighbors." You know, and the correct way to find your neighbors is to look through your windows and search for them and preferably use a telescope. So the amazing thing is that only over the past decade, 10 years, we had the survey telescope that allows us to see interstellar objects, meaning an object as big as a football field passing within the orbit of the Earth around the sun and moving too fast to be bound to the sun. And the first such reported object was in 2017, October. That was Oumuamua. And turns out that it's not really the first interstellar object. Together with my student, Amir Siraj, we found two meteors that predated that, that came from interstellar space because they were moving too fast. They collided with Earth. They were just a meter in size, much smaller than Oumuamua by a factor of 100. But we could see them because they burned up in the Earth's atmosphere. Once again, there is a fireball. When something moves fast, we know that there is a fireball. We see these meteors. We see spacecraft when they are re-entering Earth. This is a phenomenon that we see all the time. You can't say that you see a dark object moving extremely fast. It's dark, blocks light, but not interacting with air. That makes zero sense. Anyway, so these two meteors were seen by US government sensors, and they were moving very fast. Therefore, not bound to the sun, and they came from outside the solar system. And both Oumuamua, this object from 2017, detected by a telescope in Hawaii called Pan-STARRS, and these two meteors were quite unusual. Oumuamua, because its shape was most likely flat, it was at least 10 times longer than it is wide, projected on the sky, and it was pushed away from the sun by some mysterious force without any cometary tail. So it was not the rocket effect pushing it, and I suggested it's just a reflection of sunlight. And in fact, there was an object found 3 years later that exhibited a push as a result of reflecting sunlight, no cometary tail, ended up being a rocket booster from 1966, launched by NASA, 2020 SO. So here is an example of an artificial object that behaved just like Oumuamua. And then the two meteors had material strengths tougher than iron. And the second one discovered the exploded, basically. The fireball was discovered near Portugal and in the ocean. And actually, if you go back and try to find its original velocity, it turns out that the speed that it had relative to the sun and the distance of closest approach to the sun are very similar to those of Oumuamua. So I was intrigued by that because I thought, oh, well, maybe that's just like a Dendelion seed, you know, that when this is a small object, a small probe, let's say a meter in size, released from Oumuamua. So Oumuamua was moving too fast to visit Earth, but it may have been a mother ship, a mother spacecraft that released Dendelion seeds that fell on nearby planets in the habitable zone to pursue whatever goals they have. Now, it turns out that this association of the meteor with Oumuamua is not a good one because they didn't come from the same direction in the sky. But it raises the possibility that an interstellar object would be a mothership, that it would not necessarily land on Earth, but would release mini probes that go to various planets in the habitable zone. Now, you have to keep in mind that it takes 50,000 years, even for light, to traverse the Milky Way galaxy, to come to us from the other side of the Milky Way. 50,000 years. We were not that interesting back then. We were indistinguishable from nature 50,000 years ago. You know, we lived in caves. Who would care about us? And so that's at the speed of light. And if you now take the characteristic speed of spacecraft that we launched to interstellar space, they move at a speed that is 10,000 times slower. So actually it takes 500 million years for a spacecraft like we launched to traverse the Milky Way galaxy. So obviously whoever sent probes in our direction didn't have us in mind. That's important to keep in mind, that we are not that important. You know, we tend to think that everything is about us, but if someone comes to visit us, it's because we exist, because we have nuclear weapons, because we are engaging in wars, therefore in Ukraine you should find. No, they started the journey so long ago, they have their own agenda. Why should we consider ourselves so important? You know, we started by thinking that we are the center of the universe, that now a lot of scientists still believe that we are the smartest, that there is nothing like us. And then even people that believe in visitation, they think, oh, they come to visit us because we are special and unique. It's all about us. And I say, you know, we came to this cosmic play since the Big Bang, you know, 13.8 billion years ago, the universe started its evolution. We came to it only at the end. We are not at the center of the stage. These are known facts. The human species started only a few million years ago. So if you come to a play, at the end of the play, you are not at the center of the stage. The play is not about you. And why would it be so difficult for us to understand that? Because we are so self-centered. We are driven by our ego. We want the entire story to be about us. And I say, no, it's not about us. Now, we could still have probes visiting the solar system just like they visit other stars without planning ahead of. And we have to check for that, because that will change the future of humanity. And there are these intriguing facts about the first three interstellar objects. Why are they different from rocks that we had seen in the solar system? You know, that's just evidence. I'm saying, as a scientist, it's intriguing to me, intriguing enough to write a book, Extraterrestrial, to write a second book, Interstellar, that will come out in August, and to establish the Galileo Project. I just, you know, I'm just like a kid. I want to figure out what's out there, and I don't want to believe or be a skeptic based on past traditions. We can, you know, I think actually the approach of a kid is the mature one. The kid doesn't say, I know it already. The kid says, let's figure it out. The adults pretend that they know. And that is the childish approach. So there is a reversal of roles when some people pretend to be the adults in the room. They're actually behaving like kids in the sense of not being mature. And the approach of the curiosity of a kid, you know, being with a beginner's mind, you know, being open-minded, like Zen Buddhism preached for, you know, that is the correct approach for learning about our cosmic neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, there's that beautiful story about the Zen master who is receiving a visit from a student, and the student is just telling him everything that he knows. And every time the master begins to try and make a point, the student starts talking again. And, oh, I know this, master. He says, you know what? It's time for tea. And as the master begins to pour the tea, he pours and it keeps pouring until the cup begins to overflow. And the young man says, you old fool, what are you doing? And he says, you know, this cup is your mind and it's overflowing. You have to empty your cup before you can learn something new. I've always enjoyed that. And that's very much, I think, true about this current situation. You know, we've got to open our minds and sometimes empty our cup, which I think Avi Loeb does beautifully. There are a couple of factors in this paper that I want to look at with laser focus here for a moment. The optical fireball due to ionization, and then also, of course, the ionization and associated radio frequency signature from such an object moving through the atmosphere. How did you calculate this? And what specifically do these two factors entail with regard to potential interstellar objects entering Earth's atmosphere?
Right. It's relatively straightforward. We know it from the motion of bullets through the air. So what the bullet does is pushing the air ahead of it. And of course, that depends on the cross-sectional area of the bullet as to how much air it pushes. Okay, the resistance to the motion of the bullet increases with the area of the bullet. And we are talking about objects, let's say, moving faster than the speed of sound. So in that case, it's just the area of the object that creates what is called a shockwave in the surrounding gas. And it's a shockwave because the bullet is moving faster than the sound, which is true of, for example, artillery shells. They move at five times the sound speed. You know, they create a shockwave, a blast wave around them. And so if you imagine now taking this artillery shell and actually boosting it in speed from 1.5 kilometers per second, which is the somewhere between 1 and 1.5 is the typical speed of an artillery shell, but boosting it by a factor of 10, the escape speed from the Earth, which is 11 kilometers per second, then something else happens. You release so much energy by this piston pushing against the air. It basically heats up the air at a rate which depends on how fast it's moving. So there is a certain flux of mass per unit time impinging on the surface of the object. And then you multiply that by the speed to get the kinetic, the energy that is being released per unit time. And you end up with a very large amount of energy that is being released per unit time for very fast moving objects. And this creates a fireball. It's just like an explosion. Just to give an example, a meteor of roughly a meter in size that moves through the air at the escape speed, just a piece of rock the size of a person moving through the air creates as much energy as the atomic explosion of the Hiroshima bomb.
Wow.
Okay. So, and you ask yourself, well, how frequently does that happen? It happens once a year. Oh. Once a year, an object the size of a person, a rock from the solar system, collides with Earth every year and releases as much energy as the Hiroshima atomic explosion. Just keep that in mind. Now, why don't we hear about these so-called the atomic explosions in the Earth's atmosphere every year? It's because they take place 30 kilometers above sea level. Okay, so they do not create as much damage as the Hiroshima bomb which exploded about a kilometer over Hiroshima. And the reason it was designed to explode there, it was not the friction with the air. It was the actual, you know, nuclear material that caused it to explode. And the trigger was a kilometer above the city so that it will create a lot of damage. Okay, that was the purpose, the military purpose of the Hiroshima bomb. But a meteor has no military purpose. It just explodes wherever the stress exerted on it exceeds the material strength of the meteor. Usually it's a rock, it's a stone. So it disintegrates at an elevation of about 30 kilometers high up in the atmosphere. Now, the interstellar meteors that I described before, they actually exploded at an elevation of about 10 to 20 kilometers, very low in the atmosphere. And that allowed us to conclude, even though they were moving extremely fast, to conclude that they had a very strong material making them, tougher than iron, tougher than all the space rocks that we had seen from the solar system before, in the same catalog, 272 of them. And you ask yourself, why would the first two interstellar meteors be so different from the population of space rocks? The chance of getting them from the material strength distribution of space rocks was 1 in 10,000 for these two objects combined. And so one possible explanation is to say, well, they originated from something different than a planetary system like the solar system. Maybe a different astrophysical natural system, like, for example, a collision of two neutron stars or a supernova or something else. Another possibility is that these were artificially made objects. They were made of some alloy that, like stainless steel, something that can sustain much higher stress than rocks, than stones. And that's another possibility. And the way to figure it out is, again, by finding evidence. So we have an expedition to the Pacific Ocean in 2 months, fully funded at $1.5 million. We selected the boat. We have an exceptional team of people who have a lot of experience with expeditions. I'm going to sleep for 2 weeks on the deck of that boat, just with the hope that if we scoop the ocean floor and use a magnet, and we actually localized this site better than the government did, to within a kilometer wide strip, so we know where to go, we might not find anything. But if you don't search, obviously we'll never find anything. My wife asked me the other day, she said, are you sure you will find something? Is it worth your time? I said, we have to search in order to find something. We can't just say, oh, we will not find it, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Just like people saying, oh, everything in the sky is rocks, natural rocks. Obviously, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. To find extraordinary evidence, you need extraordinary funding and the willingness to do the search. You can't just say it's extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. You have to look for the evidence. And that's what we will be doing. So altogether, coming back to your question, the idea is that an object moving at a high-speed supersonic through air would create some fireball depending on its speed. And now you ask yourself, how do I infer the speed? You see it moving on the sky, and the speed that you infer is proportional to the distance that you estimate for the object. The larger the distance, the higher the inferred speed is based on the motion on the sky. And so the amount of energy released goes like the velocity to the third power, and also proportional to the cross-sectional area of the object, mm-hmm. like the bullet I was mentioning before. So the cross-sectional area, given its angular size, it's the size that you see on the sky with your telescope, the actual physical size is proportional to distance again, because you see a certain angle, and the actual physical size is proportional to the distance. So you get the area being proportional to distance squared, the physical area, because it's the size squared. And then you get the velocity proportional to distance, and the amount of energy released per unit time is proportional to the velocity cubed. Mm-hmm. So altogether, you end up with dependence on distance to the fifth power. Extremely steep dependence. So if you make a factor of 10 mistake in the distance, let's say you think it's at 10 kilometers, but it's actually at 1 kilometer away from you, then you get the amount of light emitted by the interaction with air wrong by a factor of 100,000. That's huge, a factor of 100,000. And therefore, it only underlines the need to know the distance extremely well. If you don't know the distance extremely well because you measured the object just from one side, then you can put a constraint on the distance. If you don't see a fireball, it means the distance must be smaller than something, which is pretty much what I did in the context of the Ukrainian report.
Absolutely. And Avi, I should point out, by the way, since I wasn't able to join you on the deck of that ship in the days ahead on this expedition, Dr. Loeb has been kind enough to tell me that he is going to be equipped with Starlink satellite internet and that he has agreed to send special updates to the debrief about the expedition as it unfolds in the days ahead. So you'll be able to find out more about that in almost real time over at thedebrief.org. Really exciting to hear about that expedition and much more. And we have much more to discuss about this paper about placing physical constraints on UAP with Dr. Avi Loeb here in a moment on the Micah Hanks program. Welcome back. Wrapping up this conversation with Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb, who is the co-author of the paper that we are discussing this week. Co-authored, mind you, of course, with the head of the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick. And that certainly put this paper on my radar. And in fact, radar and other things have a bit to do with the conversation we are having about how physical constraints using known physics might be applied toward these highly maneuverable objects that are detected by the military in our airspace. Now, getting back into this conversation, Avi, where we left off, I also want to ask you really quickly about the detectable signature of the radio frequency emission prior to the onset of the fireball. Now, if I'm reading this correctly in the paper, does that seem to indicate a potential detection method that would occur prior to the luminous phenomena produced by the fireball?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Yes, indeed. As the object moves through air, it heats up the air and breaks atoms into their electrons, which are negatively charged, and ions, which are positively charged. Now, these electrons reflect radio waves. So it's called ionization, this breaking of atoms or molecules into electrons and ions. And the electrons are much lighter than the nuclei of atoms, and so they reflect radio waves much more effectively because they move under the influence of radio waves, and basically they can act as a mirror. And so what happens is you end up with a cylinder which defines the path of this object through air, which has a cross-sectional area for the radar. Is so the cross-section, the radar cross-section is basically the area projected on the sky of this cylinder of ionization, the trail from the motion of the object. So, you know, if it's just a meteor that explodes in a fireball, then you end up with an ionized region, which is just a sphere surrounding the meteor. But if you consider an object that does not explode, that basically continues to move, there will be a cylinder, and the length of the cylinder will actually increase the radar signature that you should be looking for. So we are using in the Galileo project a passive radar. We don't want to create any problem with military equipment flying in the sky and so forth. So we are not transmitting anything. There are radio stations all around the US, let's say. And the radio waves from those radio stations reflect off any object in the sky. So we are trying to detect that. And you can triangulate also by these reflections, because you can use the passive radar in several locations and then triangulate and find the location of the object. So we are developing that technique, and radars are used in almost all countries to monitor the sky, even active radar. So the idea is that if an object moves fast, you should see the footprint of that object on the sky, which would be basically the radar cross section proportional to the length of this ionized cylinder that I was talking about.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because it sounds to me like it's a very useful method of potentially observing these objects by virtue of being able to have that radio signature prior to their actual appearance in terms of the luminous aspect of their appearance. Dr. Loeb, in the past, and actually earlier in this interview, you've said the sky is not classified. I love that quote. And naturally, Galileo Project is working with information that is publicly accessible. It must have been interesting, of course, working with Dr. Kirkpatrick on this paper, because he, of course, has access to and has been made privy to some of the best classified data on this topic. But in recent days, with the shoot down of balloons over, suspected balloons, I should say, over the United States and Canada, a lot of skeptics have kind of looked at this and said, well, it's probable then that a lot of the things that the UAP Task Force and now Aero have been looking at were just balloons. And in fact, in that 2022 report, it said, you know, balloons and balloon-like objects. I would infer, though, that if Dr. Kirkpatrick is working with you on how to detect interstellar objects, and possibly, even those which may be of technological origin, that he is very open to the idea that there are other things. The fact that the paper is specifically addressing highly maneuverable objects, again, to me, this says a lot about Dr. Kirkpatrick and what he's looking at. Could you speak a bit to that point based on your interactions with him writing this paper? What does that tell you? What can you infer about the government's position on UAP based on your work with Dr. Kirkpatrick?
Okay, so, you know, here is my understanding that I don't believe in conspiracies.
Right.
Okay. What I think is, you know, you can imagine the government being incompetent. That's a realistic scenario, much more realistic than conspiracies. So the government is not a scientific organization. Their day job is to protect national security, the safety of military personnel. That's what their day job is. And if they see objects that do not belong to other nations, you know, that do not pose a threat to national security, it's outside of their jurisdiction. Okay, so now, you know, they can attend to it, but if they prove to themselves that these are not made by China and not by Russia or by any other adversary, they might leave it off the table for now. On the other hand, as a scientist, I care only about these objects. So if I see human-made objects, they are not of interest to me. I'm happy to transfer the data directly to DC. If these are natural objects, to some zoologist in some university. I don't care about birds. I just want to see if there is anything else. Because even if we find one object from extraterrestrial origin, it will change the future of humanity. So I know that it's a mixed bag. As you said, half of the objects mentioned in the latest 2022 ODNI report were mentioned to be balloons, half of them. So obviously balloons are quite prevalent. But the one feature of balloons is that they are carried by air. Most of the time, they don't maneuver, and you can easily tell the difference between balloons and objects that maneuver. So what about the other half? I mean, there were some drones mentioned, but only 20 or so in the report. So I suspect, here is my, you know, the way I think of it.
Yes.
I think the government, they cannot release the data. It's classified because the sensors used to collect the data are classified. Okay, so they are just puzzled. That would be my guess, because they are not necessarily scientists. And then, you know, the common thread between me and Sean Kirkpatrick is that he also has a scientific career before he went to government, you know, so he knows how science is done. So my point is that what I'm doing as a scientist, what the government is doing as a matter of national security, are complementary. And therefore, in principle, we can cooperate. I don't need to see anything that is classified if it's a matter of national security. But at the same time, if the government has information about something extraterrestrial, it should not be the privilege of the President of the United States to know about it more than any other person on Earth. because extraterrestrial technology should not adhere to national borders. It's just like saying Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin did her first PhD in astronomy at Harvard Radcliffe 100 years ago. Would you imagine that this information that she found, that most of the ordinary matter in the sun is hydrogen, should that be the privilege of the president of the United States to know first? No, she published it. All humans were able to see this result. Okay, so anything that we find about the universe at large, anything to do with our cosmic neighborhood, should be shared by all humans. This is knowledge that is scientific, has nothing to do with national security. So therefore, I say the job of a scientist like myself and the job of a government employee like Sean Kirkpatrick are complementary. We can help each other. I can alert him to any objects that are not of interest to me. And I'll be happy if he says, look in that direction, there is an object the Galileo Project might be interested in. And so my point is, we can help each other. There is no reason for suspicion, because, I mean, the scenario that I can imagine is if the government has data on some unusual objects, they just don't have the scientific expertise to figure it out necessarily, and unless they would conduct research into this. And, you know, it's not the duty of military personnel to figure out what unusual objects are. It's supposed to be the job of scientists. You know, that's what we do for a living. So I'm here to serve in that capacity. And if people in the general public care a lot about this question, the government cares about this question, then I feel it as my civil duty to help them. And I don't care really what other colleagues in academia say. And I don't care what believers in the general public say. What I care about is, what is this? I mean, what is up there in the sky? Can we explain all of it?
Yeah, that's a very respectable position. I agree with you too, Dr. Loeb. You know, you never should compel or appeal to conspiracy or need to feel like you have to do that to make an argument. And so in this case, again, what does the science, what does the data say? I will ask you this, of course, since obviously you and Dr. Kirkpatrick have co-authored this paper. The Galileo Project is cooperating with AERO and supplying information data to them. Is that a formal arrangement?
No, no. He didn't ask for it, and we are not doing it at the moment. It's not as anything. The only thing that exists at the moment is this collaboration on this paper. That's it. And, as I said, I mean, I'm happy to focus just on the science of extraterrestrial objects. You know, that's pretty much what I care about. It would be really boring if I find objects with made in China on them. I don't really care about the Chinese. There are nothing spectacular in my book. Okay. The same is true about birds. You know, we've seen birds for so many years. Okay. There might be a bird that behaves in a way that we never expected. I don't care about that. But if we do find something beyond these two classes of objects, that would change the future of humanity. Just think about it. So why should I care about what the Chinese are doing? Now, if the government shoots down balloons, I would cheer for it because it reduces the noise, okay? In the sense that I don't need to think about balloons because the Chinese will not do it again, okay? So it reduces one source of noise. Now there would be fewer balloons. Great. If we now look at the sky, we don't have to deal with what is a balloon if there aren't any balloons out there. I'm really happy. The other reason I was happy when they shut down the Chinese balloon was that, you know, it shows that it's a matter of national security, what's up there in the sky. The stigma was lifted in a way, because now when it's when you improve the capability of sensors that NORAD is using, that means that people, you know, there will be eyes on the sky. It doesn't really matter who the messenger is, whether the government detects unidentified objects from extraterrestrial origin or its scientists. I don't really care who sees it first. I just want us to look. And in the past, you know, there was a stigma about looking because there were lots of unsubstantiated claims. So on the one hand, you have people who believe but don't have the evidence. On the other side, you have people who say, I don't want to be in the same bed with those people, and therefore I will not collect the evidence. So that's an unhealthy situation. But if the government realizes there might be risks to national security in the sky, and they improve the sensors, you know, they would see whatever is out there. And I don't care who finds them first.
We have a few hurdles yet to overcome, but I am very glad that you are the man on the case, Avi Loeb. And again, it's always a pleasure to catch up and talk with you. Last question, of course, where will we be able to find your book? And that's coming out in August, the new one, Interstellar?
Yeah, it will be everywhere. It's published by HarperCollins. And also, you know, check out the outcome from the expedition. You know, we'll have it in a couple of months. There will be a lot of exciting things happening in the coming months. So, you know, science is not necessarily boring. That's my message.
Oh, no, it's not boring at all. And if any reader of Our Cosmic Neighborhood, your column over there at The Debrief, will know that. We'll, of course, have links to Avi's website, Avi's ongoing contributions there at our website, and where you can find him elsewhere online in the show notes. But I want to thank you, my friend, for being here. It was a wonderful conversation, as they always are.
Thank you, Micah. It's a pleasure.
Indeed, the pleasure is always mine. It's great to talk with Dr. Avi Loeb, somebody who is both uplifting and also enlightening, and that's one more reason we are so thrilled to feature his column, Our Cosmic Neighborhood, over there, which you can find at thedebrief.org for regular updates from Dr. Loeb on the Galileo Project and so much more. And I appreciate him taking the time to update us on this very important paper he co-authored with Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick. Maybe Dr. Kirkpatrick can join us here on the program next, huh? But for right now, that about wraps things up. As always, you can follow my work and the entire team over at thedebrief.org. You can also keep up with me online at MicahHanks.com. Email me info@MicahHanks.com, and of course at MicahHanks on Twitter. That about wraps it up for this week's installment. You guys take care, and as always, stay strange out there. I'll catch you next time here on the Micah Hanks program.